Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. My name is Jordana Kirshner. I'm a partner at Bask & Kirshner & Thorpe, a small private practice firm in Newton specializing exclusively in family law. I've been practicing family law for 12 years. I'm a former co-chair of the BBA's family law section, and I'm happy now to be working on their CLE committee, bringing this kind of programming to you. So now I will turn it over to our two panelists we're very happy to have with us today. We have with us Whitney Duvall. Whitney has served as a litigation attorney for the Department of Revenue for over 16 years. She began in the litigation department for Suffolk County, where she worked for almost 10 years. Whitney currently works as a supervising attorney in the litigation department for Essex County. We also have with us attorney Peter Rensko. Peter has been an attorney with CSE for 16 years. He was originally a litigation attorney in the Northern region, covering Middlesex and Essex counties. 7 years ago, he transitioned to the Office of Chief Legal Counsel in Boston, and he is currently the director of the CSE Problem Resolution Office and a supervising attorney for specialized enforcement and parentage subject matter expert for policy and procedure. So we've got two experts with us today, and I'll turn it over to them.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think what we'll do is we broke this down into a few different sections. I'm going to give a generalized overview of our agency and some of the history of child support. Whitney will talk about specific child support hearings that are done with DOR. And then we'll get into both tips for working with DOR and some of the ways that private counsel may interact with us and best ways to communicate with Department of Revenue. So you may hear Department of Revenue has quite a few acronyms throughout our agency. And one of the big ones is we call ourselves a Title IV-D agency. And what that means is that child support enforcement was put together under federal law as part of the Social Security Act. And the federal government required each and every state to create their own child support enforcement agency to collect child support in their state. All of that's overseen by the Office Child Support Services. That's the federal version. And they promulgate regulations that each of the states must follow. So once the Social Security Act said that each state needed to create a child support agency, in Massachusetts, we were created under 119A. So if you go to Chapter 119A, you will find pretty much every type of enforcement that we can do, as well as administrative review, judicial review, it lays out the groundwork for the entire agency and had to make sure that there were certain laws and state statutes that we have in place to be in compliance with federal law. So, Department of Revenue. Just for some context, last year collected over $600 million of child support. We have just under 200,000 cases. And currently, about three quarters of those cases are non-TANF, which is transitional assistance for needy families. When the child support agency was first started, almost all cases were public welfare cases. Back then, it was AFDC. So as that has transitioned, the agency is now also receiving applications from people without any sort of connection with either public assistance or Medicaid. So how does DOR get involved? How do we get a case? So it's either referred, like I said, either through Department of Transitional Assistance or MassHealth or Medicaid. And for those cases, the custodial parent must cooperate with Department of Revenue to continue to receive those, to be eligible for those benefits from the state. A parent, custodial parent, or guardian, caretaker could also just directly apply for services with Department of Revenue. We could also receive a case from another state agency or another country, or in some cases, the Department of Children and Families sends the case to us. So once we receive a case, we consider everyone to be a customer of Department of Revenue. So that includes the mother or the father, you know, the payor or the payee, or the guardian. They're both our customer. And when we get into some more detail of the different services we provide, you'll see that we do provide services to both parents. There is no attorney-client relationship. I mean, this is a common misconception that we've dealt with for many years. And it's the first thing I think probably Whitney or myself would say when we're at court. I do not represent you. I do not represent your child. I do not represent either of you. I only represent the Department of Revenue, my agency. So we are not attorneys for the child. We are not attorneys for either parent, even though many people think we are, including the court sometimes. So we can go to the next slide. Okay. So when Department of Revenue receives a case, they're different levels of a case with us. So this slide shows kind of a diagram that everything's within, and then some of them are just a section of that. So a 4D full service case means that all services are provided by us. So a TANF case is going to have that, or if a custodial parent applies and asks for all services, all of our child support services would be available within that case. Another option, instead of all full services, and full services is going to include all enforcements, would be non-4D wage withholding. And in that case, the only thing the Department of Revenue is doing is the income withholding order. So the court orders income withholding only through Department of Revenue. So we're essentially just a pass-through. We will implement the IWO with the payor's employer, get the money, put it out the door to the custodial parent. And what's important to know about those cases are that no enforcements are going to occur. We're not going to certify our balances. So we're not monitoring the payments. It would show amounts coming in and out, but we would not be able to certify missed payments to the point where we would do enforcement or file a contempt. And then the other version is state case registry only. And this is federal law that every single child support order in every single state needs to be registered with the 4D agency within that state. So the only role we're taking is essentially saying there is a child support case between this person and this person. There's no payments coming in through us. There's no enforcements. There's no monitoring of the amounts. So that's essentially for federal accounting purposes so that, you know, they could tell how many child support orders are in each and every state.
Before we move on, Peter, I just wanted to ask a question. So with wage withholding, is that only possible for a W-2 employee? So for example, if somebody, the payee, is self-employed, they own their own, you know, gas station or something like that. Is there any way to do wage withholding from that, or does it have to just be a W-2 employee?
It does not only need to be a W-2 employee. Independent contractors would also be subject to wage withholding. In 119A, Section 12 of the wage withholding is any and all periodic income. So, for example, unemployment, certain disability benefits, Social Security, retirement, all of these would be withheld. A self-employed individual is a little different because they're running their own books. So even though an income withholding order may go to them, if they choose not to do what they are statutorily required to do, we would have to take additional steps with a self-employed individual. In those cases, sometimes they may have like a payroll company, like a Paychecks or something, where they would just give it to them and let them do it. The income withholding order, it's 4 pages. I mean, we can get into more detail on that if we want it further down in the presentation. But there are certain instructions for how they would do that. So we have sent it to people that are self-employed, and then whether or not they comply and whether we're going to need to file like a contempt against them as a business, as a corporation or incorporated, would come down to whether or not they're following that income withholding. So, well, like I said at the beginning, the federal government pretty much set forth requirements for what each of these 4D agencies need to do. And these are services that Department of Revenue provides. So locating parents. Location is a key piece that the federal government wanted us to be able to do. There's a federal parent location service that we are hooked up to, which each state is hooked up to. There was historically a lot of concern that a parent was just leaving the family and be parts unknown. So we have location services. We have different ways, most of that through the Social Security number, of finding parents. Establishing parentage is a huge part of the program. It's one of the pieces that the federal government gives incentives and penalties on. So any cases that come through us as an application where parentage is at issue, we are going to establish parentage. That includes genetic marker testing, which is paid for by the Department of Revenue. Obviously, establishing any sort of child support, health insurance order, including medical support orders. Modifications, federal government asks that we are reviewing these every 3 years. So modifying child support orders, and this would be an example of a section where we serve both parents. So the payor is a customer, and if we find that their circumstances have significantly changed, they're incarcerated, they've lost their job, they're on unemployment, Department of Revenue would be moving forward with a review and adjustment and seeking a lower order. Of course, after we have that order, Department of Revenue enforcing a child support health insurance order. We have multiple administrative enforcements that we must have per the federal government, and they're under 119A. And then, of course, collecting and dispersing. So all money that's coming in is then going out. There's strict federal guidelines for how long it takes to have money come in the door and go out. Also posting hierarchies of, we have this chunk of money that came in, but they're three parents. There's certain ways that we need to spread that money for the federal posting hierarchy. So, enforcements. So if you've fallen behind in your child support obligation, then Department of Revenue is going to take certain enforcements. And I guess I don't see it here, but the first thing is going to be your annual notice. Once you've fallen behind by a certain amount, the payor is going to receive a letter saying, you owe X amount. Here are all of the enforcements that Department of Revenue could take to collect that amount. And that puts them on notice, due process. And they could, at that point, if they say, well, my goodness, this is all wrong, I've paid directly all this time, they could contact Department of Revenue to get that straightened out. If nobody contacts, these are all the administrative enforcements. We have the ability to intercept both federal, state income tax returns. We can make income withholding and unemployment, workers' compensation cases, taking from either the weekly amount or from the lump sum. You can file property liens both to the Secretary of State, real estate liens on any real property that they owe. Insurance settlements, any insurance amount over $500 is automatically going to be checked against the payment intercept program and be intercepted by Department of Revenue. Same with lottery or gambling winnings, judgments or settlements. That includes winnings at the casinos. That includes scratch tickets, and that is also now including the new online game, the DraftKings, like those ones as well. We can seize public, private, financial funds, financial institutions, levy bank accounts. Any bank account could be levied. Drivers, professional occupation licenses, any license could be withheld or suspended. We can ask the State Department to revoke or restrict or deny a passport application. And interest and penalties will be assessed for any month that is missed. Now, all of these enforcements are up to the discretion of the Department of Revenue as to when they will be used. And it's not an a la carte service. So if a custodial parent applies full 4D services, any and all of these enforcements may be used on their case. So they can't call up and say, I don't want driver's license, but I do want real estate. It's going to be up to the Department of Revenue which ones we will take. And obviously, cases where there are safety concerns, there may be decisions by Department of Revenue as to which enforcements are appropriate. DOR can also file a contempt, obviously, with the court for an unpaid child support, and would need to be able to show the ability to pay and comply with the order. Then I guess I'll pass to Whitney, who's going to talk about the nuts and bolts of if your client receives a notice for a hearing with Department of Revenue.
Before we do that, I actually just have a question. Sorry. So I'd just love to hear a little bit more about, you know, the contempt and the discretion that before you're deciding to file a contempt and establishing or you're determining within the department if there's evidence regarding the ability to pay and comply with the order, how is that being done? How is that assessment being done?
So there are a couple of pieces of that. So after the Supreme Court Turner case, we needed to look at our own contempt procedures. And then in light of that case, the most recent large federal regulation promulgated by OCSS talked very specifically about how a 4D agency must be able to show ability to pay prior to filing the contempt, and must make a reasoned approach to look at that, as well as to present that to the court. So we had updated our policy to specifically lay that out. So the way it would work with Department of Revenue is an enforcement worker is going to review a case, and then they have a significant checklist, significant databases they need to go through prior to it even getting to like Whitney's desk. They would go through credit reports, for example, see if a person owns pieces of property, obviously, any sort of wages, any sort of past employment, as well as there to talk to both parents. So, I mean, there are obviously cases where the custodial parent really is holding the evidence of whether or not there's an ability to pay, whether it is through text messages between the parties, things that they're posting online, that they're working under the table doing this, and that they have a lavish lifestyle, which can be shown through this evidence. That worker is going to amass all of that and make a determination whether or not that we're passing an initial ability to pay to get it to Whitney's desk. Whitney's going to then look at it. She may have further questions for either the custodial parent or the worker who did it, and make a determination that she feels confident enough that to file it and say, I think I can get in front of a judge, and either with the custodial parent's testimony or with what Department of Revenue has, be able to show an ability to pay to get over that initial hurdle. And if, for example, if they got to court that day and things have certainly changed, I mean, Whitney could obviously dismiss the complaint for contempt prior to hearing. If, you know, the other parent comes in and shows they're clearly disabled, or mother's claims of this lavish lifestyle don't have any basis, she could dismiss it at that point. And then any parent could obviously file their own pro se complaint or through counsel.
Okay, so I think at this point we're going to switch gears just a bit and go over the two types of sessions that the department has for court hearings. And when the department files the underlying action, we are responsible for arranging for service on the defendant and for scheduling the matter in one of our two types of sessions. Now, some of you might remember the old block time session pre-pandemic. For example, in Suffolk County, it was 100 cases every Thursday in person, probably the day you tried to avoid the courthouse. But obviously, when the pandemic hit, we, like everyone else, had to change our process. And what we did was create this case conference session. And this particular session has been very well received. It provides a convenience and an efficiency to not only our customers, but also to the court. And so because of that, we have maintained this session even after the pandemic has subsided. And we have continued to refine it and streamline it. And it is now our main session where the majority of cases will be heard. So what it is an entirely virtual session via Zoom. So there is a video function to it, but if customers don't have the capabilities for that, it can also be done simply by a phone call. So just like making any other type of phone call. It is one day every week for every county. Right now, we have three recalled judges who hear all of the cases statewide, and that is regardless of county. They hear all of our cases. And what will happen if your case is put in this session is you would receive notice in the mail with a specific date and time to dial in. And when you dial in, you would meet with a DOR representative. Most likely, these sessions are scheduled in hour-long blocks, so the conference would be an hour or less. And in that session or conference, we try to determine if we're able to reach any type of an agreement. And if we have an agreement, then the department drafts that agreement. We email it to parties via Adobe Sign, and then the parties and attorneys sign electronically. We then submit that electronically to the court for administrative approval, and there is no hearing. So your day is done at that point. Then if the matter is contested and we're not able to reach an agreement, you will be given a second Zoom link, which will dial into the court, and you'll be given a specific time that same day to dial into the court for the hearing. So I think from an attorney's perspective and for scheduling purposes, I think it's really important to remember that when you get that notice from DOR that says you have a conference at 11 a.m., just be aware that there may be an additional time later that same day when you may be required to call in for a hearing with the judge. And then most importantly is please only use the link that is provided by DOR. We have specialized devoted lines with DOR and the court. So please only use that. We have had many, many instances where attorneys have looked up the case on MassCourts, found the Zoom link to the judge they think is hearing the case, and then they've sat in empty Zoom waiting rooms for hours with no knowledge for us. So it's very important that you only use the Zoom links that DOR provides. So that's our case conferencing session. And then that is in contrast with the block time session, which is a little bit more like the traditional pre-pandemic session, but with some adjustments as well. So in this session, we do have the capability of having in-person hearings for contempt actions or any action where we feel like it's essential that the parties are in person. But we will also have virtual hearings in this session as well. For this session, it's far less frequent. Depending on the county, it is once or twice per month. I believe right now Suffolk County is doing twice per month. And the judges that hear these cases are the divisional judges. So they are based by county. And I can't really speak to the format of the block time session because it does vary from county to county. Each county determines, how they would like to structure the block time session. So in Essex County, where I work, we really have mirrored the case conferencing model. So if you have a block time hearing in Essex, you would get a notice with a time to call in. You would meet with the DOR representative first, and then you would be given that second link to dial in to the court hearing. And just like with the case conferencing session, only use the link that is provided by DOR.
So, Whitney, you may be able to only speak to Essex, but can you give a sense of, in maybe it differs in the different types of sessions, how many participants are pro se versus represented?
Well, I think the answer to that question really does not vary whether it's case conferencing or block time. I think we see just as many private attorneys in the case conferencing session as we do in block time. Pete probably has statistics on this. I don't. As to how many cases in our inventory are represented by private counsel and how many are pro se, but I don't see any difference between the case conferencing session and the block time session.
Overall, then, are more people pro se and during these processes, or represented, or sort of equal, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think overall the DOR inventory, our caseload is more pro se. But certainly, I think I'm at least in Essex County, I am seeing more and more represented litigants. But I think overall, it's mostly pro se. Mm-hmm. Any other questions before we move on?
We don't have any questions. Oh, let's see. So we got a question through the portal, and I'll just read it because I don't think the other participants can see. For any case where there is an agreement reached and the child support amount agreed to is lower than the child support guidelines, does DOR or does the judge fill out a child support deviation findings? That's a good answer.
Yeah, that is a good question. So yes, that is required anytime the court or the parties agree to an amount that deviates from the guideline, even if it's above or below, those findings are required. So from DOR's perspective, we do propose findings. So we do send that off to the court along with all the other documentation that we would be sending. And then the court ultimately would sign off on that. So as long as we're ready to move on, I'm going to turn it back over to Pete to start us off with talking about some tips for working with DOR.
Okay. So Whitney and I talked about this a bunch last week. Accessing income information. So there are a couple of ways. So I spoke a little earlier about the Federal Parent Locator Service. So OCSS, the Federal Child Support, runs, I guess, a repository of information from all the states, the FPLS. And what that allows each state to do is to get information on cases, you know, where an individual may have multiple cases across different states. So as part of that, the regulations require some access to those resources. So for example, the more common version is the court request for information from FPLS. And there's a form that the court has. And if they need information, the court can fill that out, send that to the appropriate DOR staff member in the region. They will look up information and give that back to the court. Examples would be a custodial parent is there before the court and doesn't have non-custodial parent's address. She has no contact with him, has not heard from him in years. Maybe the probation department fills that out. Department of Revenue looks it up and says, well, we have this address, 123 Main Street in Lowell, and gives that back to the court. Court can do with that what they will. Most likely, either the probation department will ask for service of process or maybe give that to the parent to do service of process upon the other person. I had another example, tip my tongue. In the past, before COVID, there was a DOR representative in most court offices. So they would be able to look up information for the probate department, or for counsel on a case that had no DOR connection. Maybe it's just account summaries, things like that. The court could request those documents as well. Now, there's another example where people can get information through the FPLS, and this is kind of grandfathered in. Like I had said earlier, more than 75% of our cases now have absolutely no public welfare component. But when the entire system and the agency was set up, the main idea was a public welfare recoupment piece. So that almost all cases were public welfare recipients. And the child support agency's task was to recoup child support amounts for those benefits that were paid out. So at that point, there were very, very few cases without a 4A. 4A means public welfare component. So this was put in. And essentially, if there is no 4A service, then a requestor could complete an attestation form for the FPLS and submit that to DOR. And they would be able to get certain information from the FPLS. So, like I said before, location information, possibly social security number, wage information if it is there, or employer information. Now, this would all mean that there would have to be information in DOR's system. If there was never any case with the person, this location service information request would come back with no answer, essentially. Now, the type of information that we can disclose is going to depend on what the request is for. So in 119A, pretty much any sort of disclosure needs a child support purpose. And that FPLS form is a little broader than what our typical requests are, because it could have to do with custody or parenting time determinations, as well as the unlawful taking of a child, which is not typically in our scope, but it is for those kinds of requests. And I think I already said this. Oh, also, not only income amounts, but also benefits. So if there's health coverage information, that would also be included in that kind of request. So working with Department of Revenue, ambiguous orders. So one of the attachments I asked the handout was DOR's determination on ambiguous orders. And this is something that a private bar needs to be careful with when both drafting agreements or having an amount set by the judge. Department of Revenue computer system needs a specific dollar amount and a frequency. So $100 a week, $100 biweekly. It can't be determined 33% of earnings or rerun the guidelines every year and a half. And it needs a specific effective date as to when it starts. So an example you might see or we would see and not be able to enforce would be $100 a week plus 15% of any bonuses received. Department of Revenue doesn't have any information as to what the bonuses were, nor way to calculate that. And even if we were able to do that, no way to process it. The system is going to set their monthly support obligation, which is that $100 a week, so 4.33 weeks. It can't just add additional amounts that may or may not be due. As part of ambiguous orders, I had forgotten to put it in the slide, but determining the end date for a child support amount. So Department of Revenue is going to treat the age 21 as the default end date for a child support order under the Shuker case. Now, if the court order says a specific date, says 18, says 23, then we're going to use that specific date or that specific language. But just be aware that if it's vague or if it's just like refer to the statute, we're going to set a 21 and you may need to go back into court to get a different date, either to extend beyond 21 if the child's going to college. Again, Department of Revenue doesn't have that information, and or to stop it before 21 if the child's left the house, entered the military, whatever it may be. Department of Revenue doesn't have that information. So in those cases too, sometimes there's an availability to maybe have a agreement where we will be able to terminate it. Example would be if both parents agree that the child graduated in May and that's, you know, their 22nd birthday, we would stop it before 23 and close out the case if everything's paid. And then I think I'm turning over to Whitney here.
Thanks, Pete. So the last two.
Sorry, Whitney, we got some questions for Pete.
Okay, sorry.
Somebody asked where someone could find the form to fill out for a 4A service request.
Form to fill out for a 4A service request. We will have to get back to you on, I don't know if that's on the website or not.
Okay. And then when you say that the DOR cannot enforce something based on contingencies or percentages, could it enforce if it had a step down? Let's say there's two children who are part of the guidelines, and it says, you know, upon the older child reaching age 21, the number will change to this.
Yes, if it's specifically laid out that way, yes, certainly we can do that. Another example where there might be a step down is somebody who has a seasonal employment. So if it's, you know, January through August, the person's employed is $250, but September 1st through December, they're always on unemployment or maybe no employment, and it steps down $75. We can make those adjustments in that way. It's really percentages that are the troublesome part that just can't be done.
All set?
Yep, we're caught up on questions.
Great. So the last two tips that I'm going to talk about really have to do with if your client has a problem with the amount of arrears that they owe to the department. And I think as counsel, the knee-jerk reaction is sort of to race to the courthouse and file something. But that's not always the best course of action because we do have these types of programs in place. And so the first program that I'm going to talk about is our arrears management program. And the first thing to remember about these programs is that it only has to do with the arrears owed to the Commonwealth. So DOR cannot negotiate or waive any arrears that are owed to a parent or caregiver. So these, what we're going to be talking about is only when arrears are owed to the Commonwealth. And I would imagine from private counsel's perspective, it might be difficult on cases to ascertain who the money is owed to. So what I would suggest is that you can request an account summary from DOR, assuming you have a power of attorney on file with us, or your client can access an account summary themselves directly from their online case manager portal. And when you have that account summary, it will say assigned arrears. And if you see assigned arrears, that means it's money owed to the Commonwealth. So when we have that situation, we have two types of programs. One is offer and settlement, and the other is an equitable adjustment. Offer and settlement is exactly what it sounds like, making an offer to pay less than the full amount in order to close out the case. It could be in lump sums or installment payments. The equitable adjustment, however, is DOR agreeing to change the amount that is owed. However, there's no lump sum requirement. It's merely paid off at the normal rate. And we do this in cases where there are doubts as to collectability of the arrears. So in other words, if we believe there was no past, present, or future ability to pay. And some of the factors that we consider are if there's been a history of needs-based benefits, history of homelessness, disability, parents who have reconciled and lived as intact families while the children are minors, and a variety of other factors, of course. As you might expect, this is not something that we do lightly or willy-nilly. It does have to go through many levels of approval through the chain. So what I would recommend to private counsel is that you can help your client by making sure that their application for these programs are as strong as possible and by providing as much supporting evidence as possible. And the customers can request these applications from our customer service hotline or through the virtual counter. The second type of program is called an administrative review. And this is done when customers either believe that DOR's records are incorrect or that we have used an administrative enforcement action, such as a driver's license suspension, when we should not have. And in this instance, someone would, again, fill out an application. They can get it through the hotline or the virtual counter. DOR would review the case. If we agree that there is a mistake or problem, we would fix it. If not, then we would issue what's called a final determination letter that provides the information to the customer. Then, and really only then, they can go to court and file what's called a complaint for judicial review. Because at that point, they will have exhausted their administrative avenues. So they can file a complaint for judicial review, attaching the final determination letter. And the important thing to remember is that you only have 45 days after that letter is issued to file the complaint for judicial review. So those are our types of some of our types of programs. What I would say is that anytime you have an issue or a problem for a client, the first and best thing to do is to reach out to DOR. And so there are a number of ways that you can communicate with DOR. The virtual counter is another product that came out of the pandemic. We have developed a counter where customers can meet with DOR representatives face-to-face over Zoom. I have the days and hours there listed. Obviously, we still have the call center available. And I would also really encourage everyone to review the DOR website. So for customers, we have the online case manager account where they can look up history of payments, the arrears balance, you know, request forms, things of that nature. And there is even a dedicated page on our website with many tips and tricks for attorneys who are working with DOR. So I would definitely recommend checking those out.
And then I'd like to piggyback on something that Whitney just said, something I just thought of that's part of arrears management in a way. In an arrears only case, after the child's emancipated, if the person owes a significant amount of arrears, Department of Revenue is going to have that income withholding be 125% of the order. And that's based on 119A, that if you fall behind, Department of Revenue can automatically charge an additional 25% each pay period to pay back. Now, what we sometimes see happening is way down the line. So, they're now receiving disability or retirement, and that 125% ends up taking probably the most amount that we can legally garnish under the CCPA limits. So in those cases where there's an arrears only aspect, most of the time the court's not going to allow the parent to come back in and file modification to change the amount because the children are emancipated. There's nothing to modify. Department of Revenue has a policy where we will modify that income withholding amount. They fill out a statement of financial condition. Certain financial forms will run a new guideline sheet based on the amount, what it should look like now, and change that from 125% to what's almost always a lower amount so that they're paying off their arrears at a smaller amount than they would be by the 125. So it doesn't impact the arrears balance like Whitney was saying, but it could be very beneficial to your client if what they're really struggling with is that monthly or weekly amount that's coming out and there's no other way to get back into court on it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. So I encourage people to submit their questions. We have a couple now that we'll go through. So I will read these out. We have one question from somebody who works with many families who have informal child support at the point they apply for TAFDC. They do not have a legal right to keep the child support, but there is not yet a DOR case. Can you please share how families on TAFDC who have informal child support should have their child support directed to DOR?
Well, if there's not a DOR case yet, there's going to be kind of a problem if you send the money to us, especially if it hasn't been opened in any way, shape, or form. So neither of these people's names are or information is in the system. So if they have an informal order, there's not really a way to get it to Department of Revenue until there's an actual court order. Occasionally, now this would be a circumstance where the case has been created, but the court order is not there yet. There is an ability if that payor sent in money that we'd be able to push that back out towards the custodial parent. Whether or not there's a TANF piece, that's going to then also run into a problem because before that court order is there, there's no way for us to really bill it. So I guess depending on who your client is, if your client is the payor and they've been giving direct pays to the custodial parent, they should be keeping receipts of this in any way, shape, or form, because we may be able to credit an account later down the line, especially if that judge entered any sort of retroactive child support at the time of the support order. So I've seen many judges say direct pays do not count in any way, shape, or form, but if they have proof of it, there's a better chance that they would count towards those arrears.
What's the best form of proof? Venmo, a check?
Venmo. Goodness gracious. I didn't have that when I was in court, but we've been able. So I had a case where a bunch of Venmo payments, we were able to do that, a cash check. Now, I would put in the memo child support, because one of our issues is if the custodial parent, we would ask the custodial parent, did you receive these monies? And you know, might be money orders. And they say, yes, but that was for a health insurance bill. That was for camp. That was for not for child support. We're stuck. And then the court's going to have to make a determination as to what those payments were for. A lot of the times on those direct pays, and this is in that same vein of like the case is just started up. So there were direct pays before the court order or just after the court order before the income withholding took place. Most of the time, in my experience, so a parent's going to say, yes, I received $1,200 via Venmo, and we'll be able to make a credit to the case for that amount.
That's a good tip, that if you're paying direct, have some way to prove not only that you paid it, but also that it was for child support.
Yes.
And another question, can the paying parent ask for DOR services to collect and pay?
Yes, a paying parent can complete an application for child support services. We would open up a case, collect the money through income withholding or direct payments from them, then pass it to the custodial parent. The one caveat on that is if that non-custodial parent does not know the custodial parent's address, we would not be able to open that case under federal law. We cannot use the location services to find a custodial parent. And the basis of that essentially is that they can't use fears that somebody would use the child support agency to find somebody where there's a restraining order, where there's history of domestic violence, there's reasons why that person is not to be found.
Is DOR given notice automatically if there is a restraining order in place between the customers?
No, there's no automatic. Typically, we learn from the person applying for services. It's a question on there. They may include a copy of a restraining order. The issue would be if a payor fills it out and writes, location of child and the other parent unknown, that's, we will look at it, but we would not be able to open that case without them having that address.
Next question.
Before we move on, I just want to say I often encourage payors to apply for our services, because sometimes it can be really beneficial for DOR to be that third party that handles the money. You know, we handle the accounting. It's right there in black and white. No one can squabble over it. And it takes that piece out of the relationship so parents can focus on, parenting the child and other things as opposed to the finances.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing to point out, and that the benefits to both payor and payee. So we've got a couple more questions. That somebody said that they have a recurring issue with DOR not collecting as of the effective date written in the order, but as of the date that DOR says it received the order, which can sometimes be much later than the date set in the order, resulting in the recipients losing out on significant funds. Do you have any suggestions for getting recipients the full payments they are entitled to? and sort of gave an example.
Oh, I don't know if we need you to. I guess.
Well, I believe this would be referring to when a case is first starting, and a party receives an order and they apply for our services. I believe we have to use the effective date of the application as opposed to when the court order entered. And the reason being is that there could have been direct payments before we got involved. We really have no knowledge of what could have happened between the effective date and when we received the application. So it's not great advice, I realize, but what we would advise customers to do is if it is a very long period of time, they would need to go back to court to have the arrears established by a court order. And once a court determines that some certain, then we can put it on our system and begin to collect it.
As in arrears.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It really depends on the amount of time in between. Mm-hmm. So if the case had been, like, I get an example here of like 1 month, I mean, like typically they'll be able to go back and do that as long as the case had been open. They can't go back beyond opening the case. But yeah, if it was like 4 weeks or 6 weeks, typically they'll be able to set that. They might talk to the custodial parent to make sure there weren't direct pays in between. Where I see it, if it's 3 months later, then yeah, it's not going to be able to do that without a court order saying how much was paid, if anything.
So what's the fastest way if somebody has a court order that says this child support is effective March 1, because sometimes there is lag, sometimes we'll get a court order 10 days, 2 weeks after the effective date. And then, so what's the fastest way to have that implemented by DOR?
Well, in that case, correct me if I think I'm wrong here, Whitney, like if the application had already been open, right? Mm-hmm. And then you got that in 10 days after March 1, there'd be no issue with that. The issue I think Whitney was talking about is if the application is well after the date and they didn't set an arrears amount.
So if somebody's going to court and they anticipate a child support order being established, could they submit an application in advance even though they don't have the order yet, and that it'll be getting in the system?
Yep.
Okay.
Yes.
Maybe that's the advice, is if you anticipate child support being established, start that application in advance.
Yes, that'd be my advice.
And there is a section on the application for if there's already a docket number. So I would just advise everyone, obviously they need to include that. Otherwise, it's going to get routed to someone like me to file a new action. So just make it clear in the application that, something's already been filed in court.
Okay, great. Last question. Now that DOR / CSE is not in the court, who is telling custodial parents that they need to do a DOR application?
I mean, my assumption is that it's the court staff would be directing them to complete an application if the order contains a child support provision. So I know there are flyers and handouts, things like that, of the different ways that people can apply. We still have even a few old, paper applications floating around at the courthouses, I'm sure. But having a person physically there in the courthouse is not necessary. The parents can apply online or with a paper application being mailed in.
And the court would have been doing that prior to COVID as well. I mean, there are plenty of sessions where DOR wasn't involved, where they should have been handing an application out with the to see if it's an SCR, like I said, a state case registry case, or if they want limited services on an income withholding order.
All right. Well, thank you for letting us go a minute or two over. And we hope that, we're able to answer a lot of specific questions in addition to the really detailed information from Whitney and Peter. So we thank our panelists for their time. We thank our participants for participating and asking great questions. And thank you, everybody, and have a great day.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.